Hi.
Hi, Mike. Happy launch day.
Dude, we did it.
We put out a teaser.
It's really short.
It's super short. It's shorter than it was when we recorded it, because we actually edited out a lot, which is ironic considering the content of our first episode. But that's fine. Short is good for a teaser.
I can't get over how bad this connection is now that we've tried other means of doing VoIP.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, last night we tried Zencastr. Can't really say too much about him because we only tried him for 5 minutes, but it did sound crystal clear.
Yeah, I was actually disgusted by how good the quality was.
Because why? Because it's too easy. Like, it's so much easier than the way that we have been doing podcasting for several years now.
I guess. I don't understand why Skype can't get its shit together.
Well, there was that tweet I found, was that like a couple weeks ago now, where somebody like posted a screenshot of basically like the spectrograph image of what they call Skype white noise, like the layer of white noise that they inject into every call to let you know that you're still connected.
Is that just an artifact, or I don't believe that it's something that Skype is doing on purpose.
Well, I feel that if anybody could make crystal clear, perfect VoIP audio, it would be Skype. Like, they're the kings of it. So I would imagine that there's a reason for it.
I mean, McDonald's is the king of the cheeseburger too. They probably make more cheeseburgers than anybody. I would not call their burgers the prime example of burgers.
Okay.
In the United States of America.
That's fair enough. Yeah, I don't know. It was a nice service. I don't know if that's something that we want to look into using. I like our methods. I trust our methods.
Our methods are fine. I mean, the call is really just so we can hear each other, you know?
Yeah.
We could just pay for like a satellite uplink. I don't think Logic's doing that.
I mean, there's
yet,
a million different ways we can do the call. Like, I've actually recorded some podcasts over Discord, and I actually prefer it to Skype, but we've just been using Skype for so long that we just keep doing it.
Well, I'll switch to Discord. All my friends use it for gaming and stuff.
Heck yeah, Discord's awesome, man. It's great.
Okay, next call. Discord.
All right, I'll try it.
Screw Skype.
So what's new with you this week?
I am on my weekend right now. It's like a weekend, retail weekend, mm-hmm. You know, like when you're working. It's just highlighting how much I hate working in retail.
It's the worst, man. You should quit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I hear that's great, quitting retail.
Feels good. Yeah. But no, I understand, especially when you've been there as long as you have. And like, it's hard. It's very hard to leave. Like, retail is a tough thing to leave. And I'm not entirely sure why. Like, there's a lot of weird little reasons, but it's just like it's a hard thing to
get out
of.
Well, I don't think it's tough. I mean, it's hard to get out of for sure. Yeah. I mean, you could literally do anything. I could go wait tables. I could go do anything. But I don't think that it's as enticing. I think the retail thing is like, you're usually working for a retail, like a multi-million billion dollar corporation or whatever, and they can afford to, you know, give little, like, you know, benefits to their retail employees, which is great, and a lot of people need that to live. But it's just the things you sacrifice to be part of this gross machine is not so. It balances it out in the end. Like, you're getting paid, you're getting good benefits, mm-hmm. You can't complain about that part of it. But the things that you give up, like I'm off Tuesday, Wednesday, and it's actually pretty cool to have off Tuesday, Wednesday.
Actually,
but
there are benefits to like having the weekend in the middle of the week.
Like you have, you can go out and like nobody's doing anything. You can go drinking on a Monday night or whatever, or, you know, just go for a run in the morning on Tuesday and not have to worry about like the weekend crowds and the bridges or anything like that. It's there are benefits to it, but it's also, you know, I don't get to spend Saturdays or Sundays doing anything with loved ones, mm-hmm. you know, like who have the days off normally. I think also your pay is kind of capped at a certain point too. So like my upward mobility is not a thing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's tough, but you know, you just gotta keep trying for those other gigs. And I know you have, and I know you're going to get out of it soon. Like, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah. What about you? What's your week this week?
Just lots of school, lots of class. I'm doing pretty good in all my classes so far. Really, none of them seem to be that difficult, except for math, which has always been a sore spot for me. So I'm just kind of working through that. It's online, so I'm teaching myself, which actually seems to work better than when a teacher is showing me, especially in front of a group of other people, because I feel like I'm not getting it while everybody else is, and that just makes things worse. So I'm trying it online, trying to see if I can teach myself this stuff, and so far so good, but the midterm is next week, and I'm not sure how much I've retained these past 3 weeks.
What kind of math is it?
This
is not to embarrass you. I'm sure myself and many other listeners.
I know, and that's like part of the thing that I'm like continually trying to remember, is that a lot of people are bad at math. But they're also...
I feel like the majority of people are bad at math.
Yeah, but a lot of people say that they're bad at math, and they're like way above me. Like, they know stuff in math that I'll never need to take, thank God. They're like, oh yeah, I'm terrible at math, but they finished pre-calculus in high school. You know what I mean? The math that I'm taking right now, this is a course tailored specifically for my degree, so... I think it's kind of like a hodgepodge of different things, but so far it's been algebra, just kind of like the tail end of like algebra, like intro to algebra stuff. And then trigonometry is really what we've been dealing in the most so far. And most, like, we just finished working with right triangles, which I was having a really hard time with. I can't say that this is going to be an easy class for me, and it is still embarrassing to a degree because, like, I don't know. I tweeted about this like a week or two ago because I was working on math like almost all day, and I was just down to the wire because a lot of my assignments are due at midnight on like Mondays and Wednesdays, which happen to be the nights that I'm like in class until 7, and then I have an hour ride home. So it's like always a crunch to get the assignments done in time. And when I finished, I was just like so exhausted. I was just so completely spent. I just kind of like... laid out my basic feelings about mathematics and how they relate to me and how I've like never understood it, which is a frustrating thing, not because math is necessarily something that's important to me or something that I really like, I'm interested in learning. And maybe if it was, I'd have an easier time, but more that I've been very lucky to get through life not having a difficult time learning things. Like, I think I've done pretty well in school. Like, I could have always done better, but a lot of that has more to do with like my attention span and drive to do well in school. Like, there have been times where it just took a backseat to other things that I was doing, which wasn't smart, but you know, that's college, especially when you go to it right out of high school and you weren't like a particularly driven high school student. So yeah, math's always just been like really rough for me in a weird way, and I've never really grasped it or retained it. I think retention is like the bigger issue. Like, I can muddle through it and I can understand enough to get done with the assignments, but the retention, even within the time span of the class, like to the exam, like that is really rough for me. I have a hard time memorizing all of the formulas and the rules and the steps that it takes and how these rules are applied at this time and not at this time. I don't know. It's
hard when you're not like fully invested in one thing. I feel like being out of college allows me, I just remember being in college and being pulled like 17 different directions at once with every class I was taking. You know, that, I guess that's the point of a major, to kind of gear you towards like one thing specifically. But when I was in school, I just remember I was trying to do everything at once. You know, I was trying to do like, you know, jazz theory, is trying to do writing and like English, and trying to do like math and calculus and everything at the same time. And it just felt like an extension of high school. I don't know. Did you have problems with math in high school?
Oh, yeah.
Too?
Yeah. No, I've had problems with math. I'd say since high school, because up to high school, I was decent. Like, we weren't getting into anything really difficult. We were doing, you know, geometry, which I'm still not bad at. Like, trigonometry is tough, but there are elements of it that I do enjoy, just because it kind of harkens back to a time when I wasn't bad at math. But when we started getting into algebra in high school, I had one teacher that just really made it difficult for me. And she just refused to acknowledge the way that I learned math. And it wasn't the way that she wanted to teach math. So she like took the portions of the class that made it better for me away, just so that I would pay attention in class, because she would like put the homework assignments up on the board, and my my way of learning was to do the homework assignments during class, which she didn't like. She would prefer that I would pay attention to her lecture. But the problem...
That doesn't sound unreasonable.
No, I know. But the problem was she got all of her problems wrong. Like 70% of the time, she would finish it and her solution would be incorrect. And then one of the more intelligent students in my class would correct her. I still say to this day that Shay Cochran was teaching our algebra class that year. She was the real pro. Our math teacher was formerly the athletic advisor. I'm not really sure why she was teaching math. I don't even think math was her major. I don't know what made her qualified because she was bad. And when I started her class and I was doing my homework during her class, whether it be on the homework or on tests, I was getting, if not A's, I was getting B's or high C's. Like if something was really tricky, like a high C was probably the lowest that I got during that time. When she stopped giving me the homework and then started giving me a hard time during class, like she would call on me during class to like give answers that I obviously didn't know because I have a hard time doing this stuff and I've never done it before and she's just putting me on the spot, which makes me nervous. And then, you know, it was a recipe for disaster. So she put me on the spot and I would not do well. And from that point on, I consistently got D's in her class. And when I finished that class, I got a D and it was the first grade below a C below a B that I had ever got on a grade card ever. I was devastated. And from that time on, like, it's just been really tough because I think that class was really formative in teaching me, you know, just like the basic formulas and tips and tricks that I was going to need all the way through college to do algebra and pre-calculus and trigonometry, all the other courses that I would have expected to take in most bachelor degrees. I was completely ill prepared because she taught me nothing and I wasn't able to properly teach myself because she just like made me feel so terrible about math all the time. It just started like a really unhealthy cycle.
Man, like teaching is one of the most noble professions I can think of, but just like any profession, I feel that there is a level of incompetence that kind of like leaks into it sometimes. Like any job, like there are great teachers and amazing teachers, and I'm lucky enough to have had pretty much only amazing teachers my whole life. It sounds like you had a bad teacher that math time, you know, or just, you know, just there have been times when I've seen like a teacher just get the problem wrong or not really know where they're going or not have control of a class. And those are like cringe moments. And I don't say cringe in the modern day, like YouTube aesthetic, like, oh dude, like that's so embarrassing. It is just a fact that I don't even want to use the word cringe. It's just kind of embarrassing. The class doesn't know what to do. Cause you're seeing an adult, a person in power who is supposed to be knowing better than you. It's where you start to break down that barrier between child and adult, where you start to see that, oh wait, this is just me, but larger, you know, this is just me, but with like more years, more cells or something like that. That divide gets broken down. And then you see that in every other profession too, I think, you know, whether it's, I think we mentioned this last week or something like that, but customer service or even like, I think Erin went to urgent care recently. Nothing serious, but I know it's called urgent care, but nothing serious. She went for some allergy stuff and, you know, some person whose job it is to, I guess they call them scribes, just got something wrong, you know, and they had to bring her in for another test or something because either something was lost. And it just, there's not the stuff you want to deal with, you know, in the medical profession. And so bad teachers, bad customer service, bad wait staff, bad cooks, they exist. And it's such a huge bummer to find that level of badness in certain, just anywhere.
No kidding. And it's like always a surprise too. I mean, at least in my experience, I always had great teachers as well. Like she was really the first bad teacher that I remember ever having. Like there were bad camp counselors, there were bad scout leaders, but she was like the worst teacher that I ever had. And I'm looking at their website now. She's still there and she's taken on more math classes. So hopefully she's learned something.
Did other kids in the class do well?
Oh yeah. Well, here's another thing. I was in a class with, it was not like an advanced class. I was never in the advanced math classes. I was advanced in everything else, but math was like, I was a dummy. And I wasn't like a dummy. I was just normal, I think. But I felt like a dummy because I did so well in everything else. But yeah, my class was the more intelligent kids in the normal section. It wasn't remedial. It was just very normal, but there were some pretty bright kids in there that were able to get it and understand it a lot quicker and better than I could. So yeah, I don't know what the final grades were for everybody. I wasn't really one to share grades, but
I'm just curious to know like who exceeded or like who excelled, who is able to excel, mm-hmm. if they're able to excel. I was having that talk with Aaron today, actually. We were talking about why I didn't go to I didn't go to public high school, and I realized I didn't have a really good answer for why I didn't go to public high school. I think I started off by saying, I didn't have a lot of friends in public middle school, and so I really just didn't want to go there. And Aaron was just like, well, that's not a good reason. I'm like, well, I mean, it wasn't the only reason. And I started thinking more about it, and I started thinking, oh, well, I just wanted a better education. And then I think about some of, like, there were kids in my grade in the public school system when I was there who went on to become, like, valedictorian. They were brilliant people, and they did amazing things. Smartest people I ever knew in my life. You know, they did amazing in public school. So it's not about, like, I don't know why I ended up going to, like, a private Catholic school. It definitely wasn't the Catholic part of it that was appealing, but it was just... It was, I think I just wanted out of my small town. Mm-hmm. And I think that was all that really mattered. I had a neighbor who had gone to a different Catholic high school in Boston, and I kind of had my heart set on that and ended up going to a different, like, urban high school. And I think I just wanted out of the small town that I was in the small circle. I wanted to see what else was out there and get a different experience. And I did. I went to school with people I never would have met in the public school system.
Was this like a boarding school?
No, it wasn't. It was a you know, just a regular, like, go okay. to school in the morning, come home in the evening.
Still, it was in your town, though.
No, it wasn't. It was. I grew up in the North Shore of Boston. I guess Malden. I went to Malden for. It's a Malden. I guess I can't say it was a Catholic school in Malden. It was called Malden Catholic. I can't really hide the name of that. It's not that much of a secret anyway. But yeah, I did. I went to Malden Catholic High School, and I don't know. It was just. I didn't even question it. You know, most people, my brother, who's younger than me, my parents threatened to send him to my high school. That's a weird thing, mm-hmm. right? You know, like I went there out of my own volition right. and because I wanted to, and my brother was like, please don't take me out of public high school. And my dad's like, if you screw up one more time, well, you're going to the Catholic school. And like, I wasn't being punished by being sent.
Yeah, it seemed like it was your choice. Like you actually had, you got to make the decision on where you were going to go to high school.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I went to open houses to a bunch of them and said which ones I wanted to apply to or something like that. It was like a little college experience, and you know, I'm very privileged and well, you know, taken care of by my family, and they were able to send mm-hmm. me there on like a very minimal scholarship. And yeah, it was just. Like to Aaron's point, she was like, why would anybody pay when you have a public school system, you know, and you're paying taxes and everything. And she's definitely not wrong about that. I just wanted to go. I didn't know anybody in that high school. There was nobody going to that high school with me from my town or no close friends. And I didn't even leave the school with many close friends. So the friend argument is really moot. Mm-hmm. I just know that I like high school was a time where I worked really, really hard, and you struggle with math, and I struggle with other things. I struggle with like biology and science, and I eliminated that from my curriculum as soon as I could. But I was super fortunate to have the best math teachers, you know, that I've ever experienced. Like I guess even in middle school and public school, they were great. I don't know. It's weird to think about now, but I might excel in math where you don't, but there are other things that you can probably, I mean, do you like history?
Yeah, I was always really good at like the social studies aspect of things. For a while, I actually thought I might be a history teacher, but I didn't feel that was grand enough. But at the same time, like it's something that interests me. Like
I wonder why I pegged you for a historian or like somebody who liked history more than anything. I don't know. I guess you're a writer.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that a big component of history is writing yeah. and scribing and things like that. So you like words, you yes. like knowing about people, you like learning about why things happened and how things happened uh-huh. and journalism. And so history just makes sense for
it
you.
It does. Yeah. History and language.
And where would math fit into that?
Yeah, nowhere. Absolutely nowhere.
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
May tells me all the time that I'm a librarian and I just don't know it yet, which is funny because she's worked in libraries since she's graduated, public ones. And now she works at a really nice private college in one of their libraries, and she loves it. And she's just like, every day I'm doing stuff, and I just keep thinking, like, Jake would be great at this because it's just, you know, it's like cataloging things and like I like numbers, but they have to be ordered numbers and they don't have, like, I don't want them to be interacting in any other way other than being like sorted. I like sorting things, organizing things in words. And in a way, like, I think a librarian would be a great job for me, but I think I'm going to save that for retirement.
It's funny. I have a really close friend from high school who I just met up with and was talking to her about, and she is in school for librarian studies right
for
now.
For a master's
I think okay. so. It has to be. Right? She's out in Western Mass doing that. And I remember when she told everybody she was going to do that, probably like a year beforehand, she started, you know, saving up for grad school and getting ready to move out of the city. She mentioned that she was going to library studies, and I had told her, because she said she wanted to be a librarian or something to that mm-hmm. effect. And I was like, the coolest people in my life have not been musicians or people that I've hung out with or, you know, anybody I've worked with ever. They've always been librarians. Like the people that have been strongly, like the most supportive people in my life have been librarians. And maybe it's because I did hang out in a library a lot when I was younger. I was one of those kids that just go to the library and hang out and like read the comic books that they would have in the kids section or, you know, but I had one super awesome librarian in my hometown's library, and she was this, and she still is. She's a punk rocker, and she had amazing music recommendations and amazing book recommendations that she would just throw at you when you walked in. She's like, "Oh, you would like this? Try this out." And you'd take it home and read it, love it, and bring it back. And she would put on these concerts. Like she found out pretty early on that I was a musician or that I was into punk rock and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so she would sponsor these beach shows, I guess, as we live by the beach. So they would just put a stage up and have a bunch of youth bands get on stage and play. Mm-hmm. And she was just so supportive of that. And I think even before that, librarians, you know, the ones that would find out that you could read when you were young age, they would bring you to the story hour. And I just think they're the coolest people.
You're totally speaking to my experience. Like, this is my entire childhood. Every summer was in the library. Like, I was the top kid every single year. And not only accelerator in school, like, you remember that? You remember AR?
No.
Did you not have that? Okay. They had this thing in school where you read books. They would have like a little blue dot on the spine so you knew that it was an AR book. And then you would get on the computer and they had this software that had these quizzes for that book. So basically it was just quizzing that you actually like read the entire book and like were able to comprehend it. So it was testing you on your reading ability and your comprehension. And you got points, and these points were added to your total. And then at the end of the year, they would add these up, and you know, if you got over so many points, you would get prizes. Usually that meant like going somewhere. I feel like I've told this anecdote on another podcast at some point, but I got to like ride in a limo one year to Burger King and I sat in the front seat. Did I tell this on this show?
Okay. No, absolutely not. I've never heard this story before. Burger King to a limo sounds like something out of Blank Check, you know, or something. Like,
yeah, like
some awful 90s kid power movie.
They got this.
The kid power movie.
They got a limo. I'm assuming this is for like probably the top 10 kids in the school. And this was like through several years. It wasn't just one grade. So like several years of kids would be doing this program. The top 10 got to ride in a limo to Burger King downtown, which is like really fun when you're in like third and fourth grade.
Did you go through the drive-thru?
No, we got to go inside, but on the way down, like when we got to the limo, they discovered that there was like one seat too few in the back, because there was like 10 kids, but they also needed like so many chaperones on this trip. So they basically put it out there as like an extra bonus for whoever wants to sit in the front with the driver. And I volunteered.
Oh, Jake.
My first time in a limo ever. And I haven't been in one since. First time in a limo, and I sat in the front seat with the driver, and I got to pick the music on the radio.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was pretty lame.
That's so funny. And was the glass partition up?
No, they did get to put it down. But like nobody in the back seat is paying attention to the lonely kid in the front.
No, they're not. The story is so much sadder than.
And it gets worse because the next year I crushed the competition as well. Like I had more points than the rest of the top 10 combined, like every year that I did this. I just really loved reading. I did nothing else as a kid. I was really, really dorky. And that year, we had, like, the week before our limo trip to Burger King, we went on a Lolly the Trolley ride. And if you live anywhere in the Cleveland area, you would probably remember that Lolly the Trolley was just this little, like, tour trolley that they would take around the city. And there's several of these, so every class would get on one, and they would just give you a tour of the city, which is kind of neat. I sat next to a kid named Devin, who was itching himself the entire time. I remember distinctly slamming my funny bone and thinking that was really terrible.
Don't call out Devin.
No, I'm calling out Devin.
Devin's going to be so upset.
I've got another good story about Devin for another time. But I remember him itching. I remember me slamming my funny bone on the corner of the seat and that hurting for like a half hour. And then I remember getting home and then spending the next full week in quarantine because I got chicken pox from that kid and I had to miss my accelerated reader trip. And that sucked.
Dude, that does suck. Getting sick.
It was tragic. But anyway, I'm off track here. I was also a good reader during the summertime. So they would have like the programs in
summer reading. Yeah.
And then you'd get the little stamps for, you know, you could like either, you could like use a stamp if you finished a book or for every 100 pages. And all I read were like big books. So, you know, I wasn't like doing stamps for like individual books read. I would argue that since I finished a book, I also get another stamp for that. And I got away with that most of the time, but I was reading like these big books, and I just remember getting like so many free books because those are the prizes. You read books so that you can pick out books. I got the entire Artemis Fowl series in one summer, just in prizes.
Oh, Aaron likes that stuff. people would make me feel weird for reading as a kid.
Yeah,
like it was. I don't. Maybe this is just a world I constructed for myself. You know, where people thought I was weird for reading, but I don't know. I guess I didn't hang out with a lot of readers.
It sounds to me like when you're talking about how you spent so much time with the librarians, like, and how you thought they were so cool, it reminds me of that Office quote where it was, he says, like, sometimes what brings the kids together is hating the lunch lady, but that'll change because by the end of the third grade, the lunch lady was actually the person I hung out with the most.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man. But no, I totally get that. Like, I spent so much time in the library. And even after I kind of fell off with the reading and I picked up RuneScape, which was really the beginning of the fall, I was still playing RuneScape at the library. So I was still there. And I was just bringing home CDs instead of books.
Oh, man. So I didn't have internet until I was probably 16 years old, 15, 16.
Lucky you.
That was 2003, right? So I got the internet in like 2003. And that would mean any internet that I needed prior to me being 16 years old was I would have to go to the library to do that.
Yeah.
That's insane when I reflect on that.
I know. And there are still people that they use the library in that way. Like they only have access to the internet. You know, that's like it's a product of not being able to pay for the crazy prices for internet.
Sure.
But back then, like, internet just wasn't as common. Like, we had AOL for a short time in our first house. And then when we moved out of town, it wasn't like, I think we maybe had it for a little while, but it was worse. Like, the service was even slower. So we got rid of it. I didn't have true internet in my home until I was a sophomore in college.
In college? Oh, wow. Okay, so you were older than me before you got internet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I had already been like running businesses online from my BlackBerry because that was all I had at home. I ran everything off my BlackBerry.
Well, okay, so I thought, so my friends would tease the shit out of me because they thought how weird it was that I didn't have internet, but you didn't have it forever.
Yeah,
wow.
I didn't have a cell phone until I was a junior in high school, and it wasn't a smartphone. It was like one of those candy bar Nokias.
Yeah, I didn't have one until college, so it didn't really. Yeah. I get that. That I understand more because I think I was given it like a burner phone essentially when I got my driver's license because I needed an emergency thing. You know, I didn't use it for any calls really. It was mostly just if my mom had to reach me while I was driving or something like that.
Didn't bust out your dad's old car phone?
No, that thing went to the graveyard of all my dad's other shit. Wow. No internet. It's just weird because the internet is so ubiquitous now that it's just, back then it was a luxury. Mm-hmm. So when people thought it was weird that I didn't have it, it was mostly because, like, oh, I couldn't use Instant Messenger, or I couldn't play Team Fortress with my friends, and that was weird. And I guess for researching projects, I wasn't able to research things easily. Mm-hmm. But that, what that did, though, I think, so my sophomore year history class or junior history class, I forget which one it was AP US history in high school, we had one paper due a week. It was a stupid two-pager, you know, but you had to present something to do with, they gave you a topic, a prompt, and you would have to write two pages on that. And because I didn't have the internet, so this must have been sophomore year before I had the internet then, that I would just go to the library after school. My mom would drop me off there. I would spend probably an hour using their catalog system and just looking up books that might have something to do, basically just doing Google searches, but through the library's computer catalog, and getting the reference numbers and going downstairs to the archives or whatever, pulling a book off the shelf, opening up the index of the book and looking for a word that I was doing. If it was like colonist or something like that, or Williamsburg, Virginia, then I would just, you know, look for Williamsburg and under that subheading, look for if it was had to do with like arms or resources or whatever, farming in the colonies, I would find that. And that's how I would write my papers, by just skimming index, going to the page and looking for a pull quote. And if I could find a pull quote, like a quote to analyze, then that would be my book that I would check out, and I would go home with 2-3 history books, and then that's how I would write my paper. And that had to be done in like one night, you know. It was whereas every other kid in my class was just going home and going online and looking for something. And we couldn't use Wikipedia was there, but we couldn't use it. It was definitely not reliable as it can be today.
What about Encarta? Do you have Encarta?
I had Encarta 96, I think.
Yeah, man, I think the last version I got was 03.
Think of how limiting that was.
I know.
Though, like that was, you had Encarta, and I would be so happy when I just do a search in Encarta, and up would come the thing I needed to research. I'm like, that's great. Wow, it's so awesome. I don't have to leave my home for this one.
Yeah. Man, that was a great resource. And in the later versions, they had games. They were like adventure games.
Mind Maze?
Yeah, Mind Maze, man.
That was so fun.
It was so fun.
I did that for hours. I would do Mind
like,
Maze.
Even when I would go to my grandparents' house, and my grandparents had like a newer computer that had like 3D pinball, and you know, like I could download games because they had the internet, or I could play Flash games online, I would still play Mind Maze. I was a dorky kid, man.
Jeez. It was fun. I guess at the beginning of RPG and for you. You know, like you could be a type of person that plays pinball or plays platformers, I guess, or anything, but you chose to play the game that
makes
you
feel
like you're progressing. You're progressing through a maze and like different levels, so you feel like you're going through a labyrinth and being asked questions and whatever. And oh man,
how do you win that game though? Because I felt like I was always going through
you just get to the end.
Is there an end?
I don't think there was.
Because I felt like I was always going through the same, like I would go through a door and it would take me into the same hallway. And I know that's just like limited graphics, but I'm just like, wait a minute, I talked to this guy in the same hallway like 3 questions ago. Am I lost?
It might have just been, you know, one of those games that never ends. I don't remember specifically a day that I beat it. I don't remember like pumping my fist and being like, Mind Maze, gotcha.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, it's just, I think if there's a reoccurring theme to the show, it's that I feel guilty for not reading books. Like, this has come up a couple times now. I really need to start reading. Should we do a book club?
Oh, reading now?
Yeah, like I used to do is
kids reading.
We tried a book
club. It was called Bantha Fodder.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like you have to, I don't know, I feel like deciding to read another Star Wars novel is different than deciding to read something that you've wanted to read for years, like something that you feel you might get something.
It's more about just dedicating the time to it. You know, there's so much bullshit in my daily life that I could absolutely set aside an hour before bed to read, but instead I'm going to peruse Twitter, and that's, you know, I can't speak to what that is. Because it's whatever. But yeah, I mean, you could just as easily just carve out an hour. Like, I could spend an hour on my lunch break reading. Mm-hmm. And I do, but they're Marvel Comics through the Unlimited app. That's,
oh, man.
That's what I replaced it. That's what I replaced my reading with, was that.
Yeah. You seem to like that. It's, I need to... I, I was pretty sure that I canceled all my subscriptions to the physical Star Wars comics, but I still get them in the mail.
Oh. Well, I mean, they're like 12-month subscriptions,
right? I know, but I feel like it's been over a year since I quit my job, and that's when I canceled a lot of stuff, including the comics.
You're not getting billed for them, are you?
I don't know. I really should look.
Yes, you should.
I haven't seen it come up on any of my statements, but I don't know. I could have missed it at some point. It's hard to say, but yeah, comics. I haven't been reading the comics either. Like, they're all still in their wrapping, and I have like a box that I catalog them and everything. I haven't read them. I should sell them. I'm probably gonna sell them.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I go through phases. We talked about that in like episode one or two, mm-hmm. and about phases that we go through, and you know, podcasts to books to comics and to music, and it just goes all the way around. And yeah. It's never enough time to do what I want to do, and it's not even, like, all I wanted to do today was play Spider-Man. It's my day off.
Oh, you're getting into it now.
I just wanted to play Spider-Man. Yeah, I am. I think I'm 30% done with the game as far as the completion goes.
That's right. Well, yeah, day off. That'll get you there.
Yeah, and I have tomorrow too, which is going to be nice.
You're going to break that 50% by lunch.
I don't want to, though. That's the thing is I'm just dilly-dallying throughout the whole game and, you know, taking super long. They introduced fast travel. You can fast travel in the game now. Why the hell would I want to fast travel when I could just swing around the city? It doesn't take that long to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's a really big city and a big environment, but the fast travel option, it's maybe by the 75%, I'll be like, okay, I need to get down there to take a picture of one building as a side quest. Screw this. I'm not going to, like, I'm just going to deal with this later.
Yeah, man, it's fun. That game looks like a blast, but I'm never gonna play it. Are there any other games that like you're looking forward to?
Last of Us 2.
Yes. Okay. All right. We're on the same page. That's like, it's one of very few games that I'm like dying to play. That and Mario Party, I think, are the only ones I really want.
I don't play games really, except like I stick to a family. I'm not even that excited for Kingdom Hearts, but I'm going to buy it and play it.
Why'd you remind me of that? Damn it.
I don't even enjoy Kingdom Hearts 3. I've slogged through the last two. The one with the Dream Drop Distance and the Birth by Sleep, the one on PSP. I slogged through those. And for Birth by Sleep, you have to play it three times.
Wait, is that the one for the PSP? Yeah. Oh, dude, that's my favorite.
Yeah, it was awful.
No, it's so good because it's three games in one. Like, it's not like playing it's not playing the same game three times. It's like getting three games in one because each character has their own journey.
Except for when you have to do the friggin' Donald Duck, Huey, Dewey, and Louie's mini games for, you know, three times in a row. That was maddening. Every playthrough, I'd finish one characters, and then I'd be like, oh, this sucks. Now I have to start another playthrough, and I'm going to have to do these stupid clapping games and dancing games. And yeah, that game wasn't fun for me. Mm. It was definitely not.
I adored those games, but I can't get back into them. Like, it's so impossible to decipher what is necessary, and just save it. Like,
Mark Hamill was in those games.
I know, Mark Hamill's in everything, but there's just way too many of them, and I can't decide, like, okay... I own a PS4. What can I play? And I think it's basically just like the remasters, but then there's like different cuts or final editions or whatever is of these remasters. I can't get it. And I know that there was like a really good sale when the pre-order, or there's a sale leading up to the pre-order of 3. I don't even know the status of these games right now, but yeah. That was one of the very first series that I really got heavily into during the very short period of time where I was into games, and it was all Sony stuff, so that was like naturally.
That game would be so much better if they just didn't complicate the story so much. Especially 2, Kingdom Hearts 2 is so gratifying to play and level up, and the equipment was fun to upgrade, and skills and reaction commands and the weird summons you get to do. Like, it was a really fun game. It's a button masher, you know, mm-hmm. you're just mashing X the whole time and running around. But it felt good, and I think that's what's going to be the best part about the next one. Yeah. But I cannot get behind this story anymore because I just...
It's convoluted. I think the writers are like... They're either taking a piss at the fans or like they're
it's
sadists.
It's just a lost thing. You know, they're just... I mean, did you play Kingdom Hearts 2?
Yeah. I can't recall if I finished that one.
It was really long.
Which one has Melissa Fent? Is that 1 or 2?
They both do.
Okay, well... Yeah, where does she turn into the dragon?
She turns into the dragon in the first one. She, there might also be a dragon in the second one. And she was also turned into a dragon in Birth by Sleep.
I don't recall, man. It was like it all blends. Like I can't keep it straight. I just, and there's the characters like, wait a minute, which one am I supposed to be? Is this one dead? Like, is Sora gone? Is this Sora X? Like, what does Roxas mean? I'm so confused. Like, I know that the characters look different, but they're all like tied into each other by spirit, and like there's like the mean versions of guys, and some guys sometimes have the black robes, sometimes they're good guys, and I just don't know. That game is a shit show of characters.
I hate it, and I'm definitely going to pay money and play the whole thing. So that's where I stand on Kingdom
Hearts.
Do you
promise to stream it on Twitch so that I can just watch you play it? Because I'm not buying game. I just can't.
But you're going to be annoyed. Me playing video games is one of the more annoying things. It's like me driving. It's terrible to be alongside for because it's slow and painful. And I walk in every corner of the map because
I feel like they spend
so much time.
I get pissed off when
they spend so much time designing those maps. And if you just run by that stuff, I feel like I'm in an art gallery when I'm playing a video game. I want to walk by every single panel and try and pick up every object. And
exactly, man.
There's an enemy over there on that side of the map.
I get ticked off when I'm playing. Like, okay, do you remember back in middle school going over to people's houses for, you know, spend the night, and you're playing a video game, but it's a one player video game. You're playing like the story mode for Halo or something, and you're like switching controllers when you die.
I was not into video games when Halo was big at that time.
Okay.
I kind of fell off with the video games after like PlayStation 2.
I love doing that. Like, those were like always like really fun nights, like all nighters, and we're just trying to beat Jack and Daxter 3 in one night, you know what I mean? But I was always ticked off when they didn't go down this alleyway, because I'm like, come on, there's probably like a precursor orb down there or something. They just like would blow past it because they're just trying to progress the story. I'm like, but there's all this other stuff. Like, think of the Easter eggs that you're missing. Even in Mario Kart, I get ticked off when I'm like, if there's only one controller and we're not able to play two or whatever, and we're just like, you know, racing each other in turns, when they don't take like the shortcut, I'm ticked off. I'm like, wait, was that a shortcut? Try that on the next go around. And I'm like, okay, it's coming up. It's coming up right here. And then they intentionally miss it. I'm like, why? There's more to the game. Just find it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a backseat driver, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I am. And that's probably why May doesn't like to play video games with me. We tried playing Firewatch together. We played the very beginning of it, and I'm not...
Oh, Aaron and I did that.
I'm not sure if it was the way that I wanted her to play was antithetical to the way that she wanted to play, or if she just got depressed by the very beginning of that game.
Oh yeah,
it's like it starts real sad.
Oh yeah, it's such a weird start to a video game, just those weird menus and the choices that you make.
Yeah, it's like
Aaron and I downloaded that and played it. It was cool. I basically just asked her what we should say every time, and I tried to play to character the whole time. Yeah,
I love that, game. It's one of my all-time faves.
I didn't love it. I thought it was kind of, I don't want to talk about that because I don't want to talk about the ending or anything like that.
Oh yeah, no spoilers. But I think that game very much fits into my kind of wheelhouse for video games, especially now. I've sort of fallen into a certain genre, I guess. I like games that have a good story, and I think I always have, but there are so few of them these days, especially like the big blockbuster games. Like they're just, if they are there, it's sort of like a afterthought and the stories aren't that great. But if a game has a really good story, even if the game mechanics aren't fully fleshed out and there's really not like a whole lot you can do, and you're kind of penned into, this little maze more or less, like I prefer that to a big open world explorer. Obviously Zelda is like the exception to that, because that's really fun, but I don't mind being boxed in if the story is really good.
Yeah, I think about like Half-Life, probably one of my all-time favorite games.
For sure.
I mean, the meta aspect of that game is that there's a level called On a Rail, and because it is very much an On a Rail, you have one way you can go. It's not an open world Half-Life game. But yeah, that's so enjoyable, and I think they play on that, you know, with the main character being someone who is being controlled by or manipulated by some unseen force. Mm-hmm. So this all factors into one of our last conversations about like GPS and how I like to follow directions and maybe why I like math, if we can loop back into that.
Oh man,
you know, and why I felt good at it to a degree, like up until a point.
Yeah, no, I get that, and like it's so strange with me. Like, I always felt like I should like math. Like math totally comports with the way that I look at things. Like I feel like I'm a very rational and pragmatic person, and logic totally appeals to me. I love logical puzzles. Like I love the whole nine, and that's why I'm in like programming. I like figuring out how to make something work with pieces. And yet with mathematics, despite its logic and its rules, it doesn't click. It's so strange.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what application do you have in your everyday life for it, though? You seem like a person who does what he wants when he wants to, you know? Mm. Not in, like, a gross way, but, like, or like, a jerk kind of way. But just someone who doesn't waste his time with something that they don't want to be doing, necessarily. Like, you know you want to be in school. You know you don't. You can't be in retail any longer, so you leave retail. Mm. I just think that...
Yeah, there's probably something to that.
You just don't
that.
See the use for it.
Well, yeah. I don't know. Like, I feel like they're, especially with this class, because this class I feel is catered specifically to my degree, and there has to be a reason for it. And I know that there is. Like, I know that algebra is the foundation of algorithms, which is a major part of computer programming these days. And I know that trigonometry is going to be important if I ever have to do any sort of, you know, like, modeling in software, whether it be for a video game, which is not the path that I'd like to go, but you never know. There are reasons to know these things, especially, okay, getting into AR these days. Like, you never know if you're going to end up in a job that at some point creates a task force to create some sort of AR app for whatever it is they're doing. Like, say you work for Sherwin-Williams, and now they want an app that will map out the room within the camera view and put paint on all the walls. Like, you need to know trigonometry for that. You need to know algebra. You need to know all of these things that you think you'll never need. But I think there is an application for these things, but they're not, this class is not teaching us how that's going to work out. Like, they're not saying, okay, we're getting into trigonometry, this is how you're going to use it later. And even if they did, I don't know if that's going to help me at all. I don't think that it would, because it's the core concepts and memorization that is bringing me down. But yeah, it's a strange thing.
When you get to the point when you're learning the application, they don't have time to teach you how.
That's,
like,
yeah,
the principles,
that's true,
of it.
Yeah, they can't walk you back that far. And I totally get that. And that's why, like, I want to do well in this. And I know that I don't need that many math courses for this degree. And that's the reason that I switched to this degree from computer science, which is ridiculously math heavy.
But what if you get to the point where you do have to integrate those subjects and you realize you don't want to do that?
Well, I mean, that would be tough. Like, that's... that would definitely be really hard, but I think it's different when I'm able to, if I were able to continue doing the thing for a long period of time, that would be helpful. Because as it is now, I have homework assignments that are due on Mondays and Wednesdays. I have a quiz on Friday, and then every 3 weeks or something, I'm going to have an exam. Okay. So throughout the week, I spend anywhere between 2 to 3 hours a day working on math. And, you know, there will be at least 2 days in a row where I'm working on the same concepts as the day before. So I'm spending multiple hours over multiple days on these same concepts that are all leading up to exam. But, and that's why I'm able to get through the homeworks and through the little quizzes. Like, I'm able to get it enough to get through to that. But as there's a tail on that memory where it's dying as I pick up more things. And I would have to go all the way back to the beginning and start going through it again and do it on a loop, which just takes so much time. I think if I were to get into a job where I need to know, especially a certain number of things, like, I'm sure if I need to know, trigonometry for some certain application, I would become familiar enough with those actions, and those actions would be repetitive enough that I would be able to utilize that knowledge on a regular basis and apply it. But as it is now, like, we're moving on from, you know, related things, but different things every single day or every couple days. So don't know. It's really tough, and it's maddening just because I'm not able to get it. And I'm trying. Like I'm trying harder now than I ever have. And I think being able to teach myself is better because I don't feel self-conscious around other people that are obviously picking it up in class in front of a teacher. I feel that really helps me. Because I feel self-conscious about how bad I am at math. And I think being able to just deal with that myself, makes it a lot easier. I'm swearing a lot more. I don't let jazz in my office when I'm working on math because there's a lot of slamming of TI-84s and expletives that I don't want her to hear. And it makes her anxious. So I make sure that she's downstairs when I'm working on my homework, but
wait, your dog knows when you're saying curse words?
Well, she doesn't know when I'm saying curse words, but it's the volume that I'm saying the curse words that makes her anxious. Her ears go down, she comes over, and she puts her head on my lap. Like, she's a very empathetic dog, and I don't want to, like, bring up her anxiety just because I'm not feeling great.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, that reminds me. I have some follow-up on the dog's puking thing.
Oh, okay.
All right.
I do, too.
Oh, good. All right. Well, you go first. It was your dog last time, so go ahead.
Well, no, Olivia has been throwing up for a couple nights and just bile, essentially, from when we woke up and she was throwing up the other night. And then I came home from work yesterday and Aaron's like, Olivia threw up again. I was like, oh, is everything all right? Like, where did she get anything? And she's like, I saved it in a bag for you. And I was like,
Like,
Aaron, you never do that. Like Aaron wouldn't, you know, Aaron has a hard time picking up like dog poop sometimes, you know, like if it's too gross. And I was like, what, you picked it up and put it in a bag? And she's like, you needed to see this. And I was like, okay. So she holds up the bag. She gives me the plastic bag. It looks like a piece, like if you cut off the top of a corn on the cob, or like one side of the corn on the cob, the top side of the corn, maybe like probably 2 inches off the top of that. Mm. And it looks like she just swallowed corn on the cob.
Mm. Found it on the street, but probably, right?
I mean, I haven't cooked corn for like a month. Yeah. So unless it's been sitting in her stomach for a month, and I don't remember cutting off that much corn from it. Like we just threw the cobs in the trash.
Yeah.
So that was weird. And that's what we found with Olivia. And she hasn't thrown up since. And she hasn't, like, gagged or anything. So
that's
I
good.
Think we're okay for dog throw up after that corn went out of her. We don't know what's happening, though.
Well, that's good. If that's the issue, that's a good thing. Jazz is generally from grass. Lately, though, she hasn't really been spending a lot of time outside. So I'm not quite sure what it is. I think, honestly, it might have something to do with the fertilizer that my landlord puts on our lawn, which I hate. Because I wish he wouldn't do it, because it doesn't help his grass to begin with. His grass sucks, and it makes my dog sick. So I'm not a fan. But yeah, Jazz, this morning, she was in my office. I was working on actually putting out the tweets, launching this show, and just trying to get it ready. I have like all my shower stuff basically in my hand. You know how like when there's something you need to do, but you're also in a rush, and you know that this could probably wait, and that you really need to get going, but you're kind of like, instead of sitting at your chair, you're hovering above your chair, you're leaning down and you have your mouse and you're clicking around, you're doing the thing. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Yeah.
I guess, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm like half in, I'm like, okay, I need to get this done. But like, I know I could do a better job if I just like sat down and like devoted my attention to it, but I'm also kind of like, oh wait, I also need to go. Anyway, I'm kind of like in this rush state, and then I hear like the telltale signs of Jazz starting to puke, and it's, you know, it's just sort of like a you know, you can just hear her start gagging, and she's such a good dog. Like as soon as she knows that it's about to happen, she automatically she looks sick, like her mouth goes sour, but she also looks like guilty, like she feels bad because she knows what's about to happen on my white carpet.
Yeah.
And like I feel bad. So that today I was like, wait a minute, I grabbed my trash can and I put it in front of her face, and she didn't like it at first, but like she was so close. Like I'm pretty sure like the bile is in her mouth at this point, and she's just trying not to let it out, but there's nothing that she can do. And so I'm like stroking her head. I'm like, it's okay.
God, I'm like dry heaving right now. I hate that you're telling this story.
I'm like, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. And then she did it in the bucket. I was so proud. And when she was done, I like took the bucket away. She like looked down on the floor, like she was looking all around, like, wait, where's the vomit? And she was so happy. She just looked so happy.
Did you like give her treats or something?
Yeah, I took her downstairs. Like I made sure that she had like brand new water so she could like wash the taste of bile out. I gave her a treat. I put some more food in her bowl. I'm like, here you go. She just looked so happy because she didn't vomit on the floor. I was so proud.
Yeah, now your dog is just going to try and throw up every time.
if she did that, that'd be amazing. If she just found the nearest bucket and just like and just puked, that'd be incredible. But
there are guides online how to potty train your dog, like in the toilet, like toilet train the dog.
No.
I think it's so fun. No, look it up, man. It's there.
I've
and
seen
it can be done.
Cats. I've seen like cats that do it, and not just like in the Meet the Fockers movie. Like I've seen videos of cats that do that. But I've also seen videos of cats that think that they can do that and hit the flusher and then fall in.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it's a different kind of video, but, yeah.
You gotta have a lot of time if you want to teach your dog how to use a toilet.
Yeah. It doesn't take long to teach him some things. Like my dad's dog, we taught to ring the bell to go outside, which is a super good thing to teach your dog, especially if they're very young. Teach them to ring the bell when they need to go outside right away and you'll never have
to. Yeah.
Like,
Olivia
ask.
Got that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She just goes to the door now. She'll go sit next to the door and we'll be like, okay, I guess it's time to go out.
Jess just waits till we sit on the couch for the night and start watching a movie. Like she'll be totally fine as we're browsing through Netflix or Plex, and then as soon as we pick something and we're about 5 minutes into the plot, that's when she knows. She's like, it's time to go.
Because you decided that's probably what happened. Like you probably went to go do Netflix at one point and one of you, either you or May, was like, oh, we should take Jazz out first. And then so as you're getting ready for something, someone else gets up and starts getting her, Jazz, ready to go outside. So now she thinks as soon as you start doing something like Netflixy, she thinks that it's time to go outside. So that I just think that's like reinforcement. We subtly reinforce all these things for our dog. Like Olivia growls now. Yeah. If you pick up the leash and not like I'm gonna bite you way, but just kind of like I want this kind of way. It's a playful growl, I guess, on that spectrum, on that end of the spectrum. Not I'm gonna kill you growl. And so if you pick up her leash and you just like, you know, you wait by the door for her, she'll start growling at you. Just so like brrr, like kind of like a purr almost, and she'll like she's revving the engine and she'll like motor up right next to you and then, you know, eventually be like, come on, and she'll just put the leash on. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we're constantly conditioning dogs and they're constantly conditioning us. Like it's it's a weird cycle.
This has been Dog Puke Talk with Jacob and Mike.
Yeah, that's probably the last of the follow-up. Like, Jazz pukes all the time, and I wouldn't normally bring it up, but I was just so proud that she did it in the bucket.
Hey, if I trained Olivia to do that, I would be one to tell the world. I'd do an Instagram story on that if I was
you. Yeah, I don't know. I just love when, like I said, she's a very emotionally intelligent dog, and I think that my fondest memories of her are always like the moments where she realizes that she's done something like good, and she knows it before I can even tell her. Like she knows when she's done something that's good or something that's bad. And when she goes swimming for the first time, or when she like pukes on something that's not the floor, like, and she's happy about it. That makes me happy. I just love that.
Yeah. Olivia never does anything good. So no, the things that she does that are good are, she will cuddle you on the lap, I guess. Like she'll want to, she's very good at just like being a small dog, I guess. And not much else. She doesn't play well with other dogs all the time. Like she's kind of a loose cannon. You really don't know which way it's going to go. Yeah. And she can't hold her bladder. And,
well, she's little. Or, like her bowels. She's little.
Yeah. I don't know. I sometimes... There are ups and downs to every dog, and that's just one of them.
The upside to Olivia is that she's super cute.
Yeah, she's very cute.
Mm.
Olivia the Blue Hound.
I've got more news about my house.
Your house?
Yeah, it's a weird...
What was this?
Weird thing. Okay, so the other day, my mom came over to drop off a check. I did some work, some design work for her boss, and... she dropped the check off for me the other day, and I just met her in the front yard because I was in the middle of math and she was just kind of doing some errands and she didn't have time to stay. So we're just like chatting in the front yard under the tree, and off to the side in our front yard, I can see that there's this like mushroom growing, and it definitely wasn't there like 2 days ago because they just mowed.
I saw this photo.
Put this on Twitter. So the photo that you saw was the state of the mushroom yesterday, I believe. Yeah, yesterday. And about 2 days prior to that, when my mom came over, it was about the size of my fist, maybe even smaller. And I just remember looking at it and pointing it out to her because she actually works for a park district. And, you know, so she's interested in all this stuff. I'm like, you see that mushroom? She's like, yeah, that's a big one. I'm like, that wasn't there 2 days ago. She's like, yeah, these things, they grow fast. Like, they're amazing things, mushrooms, because they're constantly evolving. That's actually kind of a danger that she mentioned in identification, because sometimes a mushroom can look like another mushroom, but it's not the same mushroom. And so when you're like looking for mushrooms that you can eat, it's increasingly dangerous over the years because these things mutate all the time and they're constantly changing. But for this one, I was just remarking at the size and the speed that it was growing. So I wish I would have taken a picture that day just so I could like show the scale. But within 2 days, it changed from the size of a man's fist to about the size of a soccer ball. This thing is huge. And I was like, okay, so this is interesting. So I sent it to my mom. She's like, holy cow. Like she was blown away. And she sent the picture over to one of her coworkers who was actually doing some studies on fungi. And I basically was just going to, monitor it for them. I wasn't going to do like measurements or anything, but just, you know, just kind of like show them the progress of the scale, as opposed to the size of my hand. I was just kind of using that for scale. And so I was like fascinated with this thing. I was like really excited. It's in our front yard. Like it's nobody like walks through there. And our neighbor who mowed for us, they're pretty much done for the season. Like our grass really isn't growing much anymore. It's all kind of dead. So I was like, okay, let's see where this goes. But then a guy came to our door yesterday. And this is really weird because we live on like the second story of a house, and our door isn't like the first door that you would like think to go to. And I don't think it was. I think I heard him downstairs knocking on their back door. The people who live below us, they're not home, and it's weird to go to somebody's back door. But anyway, that's what they did. And then they came upstairs, knocked on my door, scared the hell out of my dog. I go down there. It's this, you know, kind of seedy looking guy, like no judgment, but like, it was just weird. Like, he looked totally out of place on my porch. Like it was just kind of odd. And he was wearing a beanie hat. It was like 90 degrees. It was really strange. So I opened the door, not the screen door though. And I'm like, hi, how can I help you? And he's like, I saw that mushroom down there. My kids saw it. I'm like, okay. He's like, I was wondering if I could have it for my kid. I'm like, okay. Your kid wanted it. Okay. Well, this isn't my land. So I can't actually like give you the authorization to take it. And he's like, oh, okay. And I'm just thinking, like, I don't really like want you to take this, mostly because I'm like watching it. I think it's weird that you're telling me that your kid wants it, because I don't think that's true. That's a weird excuse.
Was his kid with him?
No, there was nobody else in the car. I could see his car. I saw his car like when I came downstairs. Like I peeked out the back door and I saw his car parked in my lot, and I'm like, okay, there's nobody else in there. This guy's asking me for my mushroom, and I just told him no. I'm like, I'm sorry, like I can't really give you authorization to do that. As if my landlord would give a shit about a mushroom. But I was kind of selfish, and I wanted to watch this thing. I was like reporting in. It was like,
dude, you're gonna have a mushroom thief tonight.
Well, that was my thought as soon as I closed the door. I'm like, this thing is totally gonna get stolen tonight. And this was yesterday. Sure enough, I came home about 8 o'clock. It was still there. I checked in on it at about 10 o'clock. It was still there. By the time that I went to bed, which was probably about 12:30, it was gone. The guy definitely came and stole our mushroom, so it's gone. It was really sad.
What does one want with a mushroom?
Well, I was not able to identify this. It did look a bit like a giant puffball, which apparently is an edible mushroom. And I imagine that a mushroom of this size would make a pretty hearty meal. So I'm betting they just wanted it to eat it. Like, mushrooms are sort of like a hard thing to find unless you're going to look for them. But if you are a guy that knows their mushrooms and sees one in somebody's front yard across the street from the elementary school, then yeah.
I feel like mushrooms would pop up all the time on my lawn when I was a kid.
Yeah.
In the Northeast.
Yeah, I mean, we have tons, but a lot of them are like the, you know, they're like red cap toadstools, you know, probably ones that you're not going to want to eat. Must have just looked really appealing, really appetizing. And I got to give him credit. I mean, he asked. I guess that's a nice thing to do. I'm sure there are tons of people who, like him, who just go around, they see these mushrooms in people's yards and they're like, oh shit, dog, I'm taking that. That's dinner. And then they just take it because they're like, who's gonna miss a mushroom? A lot of people aren't growing mushrooms to eat in their front yard like that.
Well, he tried to do it the nice way. He tried to do it the nice way, and I told him no way, in the polite way. And
I knew what the outcome was going to be. If I had a deer cam, I totally would have put it on a porch post just to just to scare him. But it's okay. It's fine.
Is a deer cam a thing?
Yeah, a deer cam. You know,
for deer?
Yeah, they're generally, you know, they're just like they're motion activated cameras that have, you know, like a little IR sensor so they can see at night, and if anything walks by, it produces a flash, takes a picture, and
but are they for deer?
Yes, yeah, they're for deer. They're made for deer.
Why are they for deer? Why do we need a camera to see the deer?
So you can.
Is it for hunters?
It is for hunting. Some people use them in different ways. Some people actually they put out feed to bring the deer in to an area, and so they'll monitor the deer camera to just see like what's coming in, because oftentimes it's like doe, and sometimes it's not even deer. Sometimes it's, you know, like a squirrel will trigger it, or a fox or a coyote, and in that case it's if you own property, and especially if you own animals, people will use these even if they're not hunting, just to see what it is that's coming and stealing their chickens at night. Some people use it for security, some people use it so they can, like, you know,
I think it's funny to just call it a deer cam.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's how they're, it's generally how they're marketed. My dad's owned a couple over the years, and they're getting really fancy. Like, he had ones that, you put them out there, they take like 9 D cell batteries. Like, these are massive cameras, and you strap it to the tree. You put a memory card in, and whenever you want to check it, you go down there, you take out the memory card, you go to your computer, you pop it in, you see what's there, you clear it off, you put it back, which is kind of a pain. But now they have them that are like, you know, they just send it over the air to your house and so you can just monitor it all the time. There's probably some that have apps. So when a photo is taken, it just shoots it straight to you.
It wasn't the security aspect of it I was confused about. It was the idea of like, why do we need to watch the deer?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're big game hunting or looking for that trophy buck, like you want to know that there's a good buck in the area. And if it is there,
like
you
3 a.m., it's just grazing in your yard. Like, shit, get the rifle.
No. I feel like you don't have an understanding of how hunting works.
You're right. I don't. And that's what I realized as you were describing it. I'm like, oh, Jacob's relation to hunting in Ohio is probably very different than mine growing up on the beach. You know,
my familiarity is all through my dad. He's a deer hunter. He hasn't always been, though. Like, my dad's relationship to deer hunting is a strange one, and I think it's little peculiar and probably not like most, because he would go here and there when he was younger with friends. He'd get nothing. Like, he got nothing for years. He didn't get his first deer until, God, I must have been in middle school when he got his first one. And it was always a joke, because like, he would go out, but he would just never see or get anything. And so people would give him like mounted deer heads as gifts, which is like, in a way, it's like, you might think like, oh, well, like, okay, if that's something he's interested in and would want to decorate his house with, that's a nice gift. Except it's like really rude, because it's not one that he got himself. Like, it's not his trophy. It's like taking somebody else's bowling trophy. It's just, it's a thing that's going to sit in the basement. So for years he would try hunting, got nothing. And then one year he got a monster. Like, he got an award winning buck. I'm not about hunting. I really don't like it. It's something that he's interested in. It's one of his hobbies. I support that. But he got this like monster deer. He won contests. You know, he was given like cash prizes. He won.
Did he make the cover of Deer Hunters Monthly?
No, I don't think so, because there's always a bigger buck and they're always out west.
It's a shame.
But for an Ohio deer, this was a big
Ohio
deal.
Hunters Monthly.
Yeah. Like, if you Google my dad, like, he doesn't have like a web presence at all. If there is anything, it's on these like early 2000s websites that are made just for like Midwestern deer hunters. And it's like, yeah, it's like a picture that my grandpa took on like a film camera, and then they scanned. So he caught this like monster deer, not caught, he killed. And so that just like, it gave him this fever. And so the thing about deer hunting is that you're always looking for the bigger buck. You always want the bigger one for your wall. But when you start your career off with like a monster, you're chasing an impossible dream. And so ever since he gets the deer cam, he looks at what's coming in. He's savvy enough to know when a deer is related to another deer that he's killed. And he's killed like five or six at this point. And I guess you can tell by the arrangement of their tines on their antlers, like how they're related. I don't know. It's actually kind of an interesting biological study, but yeah.
Does he use firearms or does he use crossbows or bow and arrows?
Primarily bow.
Really? Yeah, okay. That's a little bit more fascinating
bow and arrow,
to me.
Like crossbow. Like, yeah.
But even so, I mean, if it's not like rifle hunting in general skews me out.
Uh-huh.
Like, but you know, there's something to be said. Like, I always thought I would never have a problem with hunting if I needed to subsist off of it. Like, if I had to, mm-hmm. which I hopefully never will. But you know, if I was in the wild and I had to hunt, I would come to terms with it and do it that way. So, and I guess the gun seems just like cheating.
Yeah, I think it's all cheap. Like, deer doesn't stand a chance. They have no way to defend themselves from any sort of projectile. I think a gun is definitely easier to use to kill a deer than an arrow, because you know, just the speed at which you can fire off shots and whatnot. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's a weird thing. And people, you know, they feed the deer to bulk them up and to bring them into the area. It's like cultivating them to die, essentially, which I think is super unfair. It's not very, I mean, it's not a game at that point. I don't know. Hunting is weird. I don't like it. It's always made me uncomfortable. I've like grown up around guns and shooting things. My dad's always hunted, but it's not for me.
Yeah. You either got a taste for it or you don't.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what deer cams are for. Now I instead of like watching the results of deer cams, I really enjoy watching, like bloopers or, thieves getting caught on Ring doorbell cameras. I love that.
There's some creepy stuff that you can see on there, like the one with the weird mask person that comes up and rings the camera. And
oh, did you see the one where the woman comes up and she has like one handcuff dangling off her wrist, and then a guy like comes up behind her and pulls her away from the door towards a van?
I don't like that at all.
No, it's bad.
It's gotta be fake.
No, well, I hope like, it's terrifying.
Oh man, I just say it's got to be fake because I don't want it to be real. Not because I inherently doubt these things. It's just I don't want it to exist.
Right? Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of scary stuff out there. There's a lot of sides of YouTube that I'd prefer not to go to. But man, sometimes this stuff like bubbles up into the actual news, and it's like, oh god, suburbs. Gross.
Shoot.
So, do we have any main topics tonight?
I think we were skirting around the math thing. I like that.
Oh,
I like talking about math.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk more about math.
Well, yeah. Or just schooling in general. I think, you know.
You want to help me with my homework?
I offered to do that like a year ago, I feel
I
like.
Know.
And
I don't want to like.
The logistics don't really make sense anyway.
Well, I don't want to mix.
Cross-country tutoring.
I think there is somebody out there who could help get this stuff through to me, but I also I vehemently don't want to mix friendship with that, because it's such like a negative thing in my life. I don't want a friend teaching me, because I'm going to be mad, and even if I tell them and they're aware that I'm going to get mad, like I can't help but think that a part of them will leave that tutoring session thinking like, well, God, that guy was a dick to me just now. Like, I'm just trying to help him. I just get mad.
I don't think so. I mean, I can't really see you being a dick to someone who's trying to help you earnestly.
Mm. We spend all of our time with each other over microphones, Mike. It's a very, I'm not, this makes me sound terrible, but no. I do get angry.
I was a math tutor.
Were you?
I was a math tutor. Yeah.
Professionally?
Yeah, I moved here to New York City. I worked in a restaurant as a busboy for three or four nights, and then I left that job on the third or fourth night, or the third or fourth day, because I got hired as a tutoring person across the street at the tutoring center. And I did that for about 2 years while I was here before taking the job in retail. And yeah, I mean, I taught kids that did not want to learn, kids that got it, kids that didn't, kids that were just there for extra help. Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of what I did. And then when it came down to getting hired in retail, I had the option. I got hired at a serious SAT tutoring place where like they would essentially give you a car and you would drive out to Long Island and teach kids, you know, paying a lot of money, like their parents probably, mm-hmm. for like a one-on-one tutor. And the interview process for that place was really interesting. Like you came in and you did the desk interview. You came back in a few days later, I think, for a mock tutoring session. They give you a bunch of feedback and then you come back the next week. And I remember my mock tutoring session, I kind of just did the math for the fake student, who was just like an employee there who was trying to do it. And I came back a week later and sat on my hands during the interview. Like I physically sat on my hands and just coached myself through getting the student to get the answer. And the person doing the hiring was like, wow, that's insane. Like I've never seen that kind of improvement in a week.
Something that you said, like, watch this, I'm going to sit on my hands and they're going to,
no, I didn't. I did it subtly. I did it as if I was kind of like leaning over the table, mm-hmm. and kind of looking in, but like hands underneath my thighs kind of thing. It could have just been like a weird affect of myself, but that was it. But that made all the difference, because if you have your pencil on the table, you kind of just want to point to it and show the student
and do it.
And do it for them. And because that you like solving problems, that's why you're teaching or tutoring math. Cause you like either like showing that you know how to do it, or you like helping somebody get to the answer. And you think that giving them the answer is the same way is going to show them how to get the answer, which isn't the case. And, so sitting on my hands just made it so I couldn't write down on the paper at all. And I forget what we were doing. I couldn't remember what it was, but the guy gave me feedback and it was funny to watch the person come around. I couldn't tell if like the fake student was having mercy on me or whatever, or not, but it went well. I got hired and then I got the retail gig, which was going to pay, it was going to be more regular work versus the tutoring thing where they start you off slow and kind of wean you into the system and gradually give you like one or two students. And eventually you're working 5 days a week. And I just decided I'd rather work 5 days a week. And that was it. And I called up the dude, the tutoring place. And I was like, I'm sorry. I appreciate the offer. I got a different job. Bye. And the guy was like, oh, okay. Good luck. That was it. And that was my end of my tutoring
career.
You're
that guy. You're that guy.
Well, I mean, I guess.
That's fine. No, there's something wrong with that. I actually, like, people give themselves a lot of heck for that because they're, you know, they get an opportunity and then they feel like they're obligated to it, even if something better comes along. I'm like, look, it's going to suck for that person because they're going to, like, think they're at the end of their search. But in the grand scheme of things, like, you're going to spend months much happier in this other job and they're going to be able to find somebody else in another week or two. Don't stress about it.
Yeah, everybody's replaceable. Yeah. No, but like they weren't counting on me by any means, so I didn't feel bad about saying no. And I also knew what was best for me in that situation, mm-hmm. and I just took it. So yeah, it was fine. I don't like disappointing people. I think you're like that too, though.
Yeah, yeah, and I think a lot of the people we surround ourselves with are a little bit like that. Like, it's almost like a self-serving thing. Like, I'm that way to an extreme fault. I do way too much work for free, and it all stems back to like, I don't want to like disappoint this person, or it seems like this person could like really use my help, and like what's stopping me from helping them. And that's why I stayed in a retail job for 3 years longer than I really needed to.
That's why you stayed, because you didn't want to disappoint anybody?
Partially. I mean, there's other anxieties like in that as well. Obviously, like finding a new job is tough. Finding a new job that you like is super tough. And, you know, like you build an attachment to the people that you're working with. And I think especially if, other players come in that provide tension with the people that your friends, you've become friendly with by working with for so long. I think that definitely served in in my reason for staying. Like I felt bad that I might have an opportunity to leave this job, and in doing that, I would be leaving all of my friends to deal with this asshole or something like that. There weren't like a lot of times where I got opportunities, but there were times where I got really close to getting great jobs and, you know, I was really far along in the interview process. And then when it gets down to it, it's like, oh man, if I get this offer, like I'm going to feel terrible. Like this is really great for me, but I'm going to be leaving my friends behind with all of this bullshit. And that's like a terrible way to think. You shouldn't feel that way at all, but you know, that's just like part of the way my brain works, I guess.
Yeah, I think I take more of like a nihilistic view of it, and that nothing means any everything means nothing in retail, especially retail. You know, I'm just a piece and of this weird machine. And
but it's so easy to feel like when you leave, it's all gonna crumble. Like you're the only thing that's keeping it all together. Really, you don't have that. Not.
No, I mean, I guess I work in a different place. Like the environment that I work in, we have a large staff, and the call out rate can fluctuate anytime. It can go from 10% one day to 40 to 50% on like a Saturday morning or something like that. You know, it's imagine 50% of your staff calling out. You just have to deal with that, and that's the level of responsibility that I deal with. And I haven't called out. You know, I called out when I got stuck in Charleston. In South Carolina because of a storm. That's the last time I called out back in March or whatever. So I don't do it often, you know, maybe a couple times a year. But there are people that just, you know, abuse attendance policies, abuse sick time.
Yeah. Okay. That's all right. We're onto something here. What are your views on sick time?
I don't use it.
Okay.
I guess that's my view. I mean, I would use it. I get sick and I don't like to go into work sick, but I feel like
you
my
use it when you're
never
sick. Like, and only if you're really sick.
I guess. I the only time I've ever been really sick is when I got, like, kind of the lack of responsibility. I got really hungover. I got really drunk and woke up super hungover. And I was like, I can't go to work today. And I used my sick time. And that was probably the last time I called out sick. And, yeah, that's okay. And like, I can count one hand the amount of times I've called out in the past 2 or 3 years. Probably.
I can count on one hand how many times I've called off from any job ever.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like
that's great. And were you rewarded for that?
No, God, no.
Tell me. Yeah, that's the thing. You're not rewarded for that.
I love this.
But why? But should you be? Should you be rewarded for that? Should you be rewarded for coming to work and doing your
job?
Well,
okay. You know what? I want to take that back. I've never been directly rewarded for coming in when I'm sick. I don't think anybody should be. I don't think.
No, rewarded for not calling out or showing up
to
work.
No, I don't think that anybody should be directly rewarded for that, but I think in the long run, you generally are, and I think you probably have been a two. Like, you're probably good at your job, and I think that played a lot into it. But I think people also look at attendance and, like, just general responsibility. Like, I think if, in my experience, I'm generally on time, give or take a few minutes, and usually that's okay, especially in retail. But I've like never missed a day. And if I do miss a day, like it's because I got really sick, or like it's a 4 a.m. shift and I slept through my alarm. That happened once, and I felt really bad about that for weeks, and I worked extra hours to make up for it. It's that guilt. But I think over time, if a manager is able to recognize your innate sense of responsibility, you're going to get rewarded for that. You're not going to get a plaque that says perfect attendance, but you're more likely to get advanced in your position based on those.
Well, when
those
there's
traits.
No advancement though, that's where the retail thing comes in. Like I don't, you were management at one point, right? Yeah. I have no interest in management. Okay. I have no interest in managing because managing in retail is just babysitting customers or placating them or dealing
with
think complaints.
And that you would be selected for that? Like you did some leadership training stuff. Didn't you?
No, I train new employees. I don't think that's the same. Leadership is just not. Here's the thing. I feel like I can do almost anything I set my mind to, which is a good. I think that's a positive mental state to be in. I think that whatever. I think it's a little bit pompous, but mostly it's healthy to believe in yourself, to not be down in yourself. But I actively know that I do not want to step into any role higher than I'm in now, because it's either micromanaging my peers or it's dealing with issues like just the horrible side of retail. And right now I get to help people.
Right.
And that is the only, that's as far as I want to take this retail mm-hmm. thing. And that puts a severe ceiling on what I can earn.
Yeah.
And for that reason, the perfect attendance thing stops mattering, you mm-hmm. know? Like, oh, yeah, I mean, basically they can just look at the schedule and say, oh, he's going to show up today. Great. We can count on him, mm-hmm. you know? Or if I'm like a minute late, they're like, oh, he'll be in like 3 or 4 minutes, yeah. you know? So that's as far as the benefits of having good attendance or doing or excelling at my job where I work specifically, because like I said, the staff is so massive that it just, we,
I mean,
there's always somebody to take your place. Even, I mean, when you have, I have 3 or 4 incompetent coworkers and they're treated the exact same yeah. as me. They call out, you know, whatever.
How do you feel when even like somebody, you know, maybe even somebody at work that you're friendly with, when you know that they're taking sick time, like whether you're working or not, how does that make you feel? Or even if it's like somebody else that you know that doesn't work in your job, like if you have a friend that is taking a sick day just so they can like chill out at home, like what is your reaction?
For what reason? Mental health or whatever? I think that I don't feel it uh-huh. as much at my job, and I also don't take it very personally. Yeah. So if I have one of those days where like 30% of the staff calls out and our ticket list is getting super late or whatever, we're going behind on some stuff, I feel bad for the customers and the users that are getting screwed over because mm-hmm. of this. But I don't, like, if somebody needs a day off, take it, you know, I'm not better than them. I'm not, you know.
Don't you ever feel that way?
I'm not gonna tut my like.
Yeah, I don't know. Like,
I don't like. I'm not. I'm never left. You know, it's not. I don't work construction. Mm-hmm. You know, that's also, you know, laying bricks a noble profession too. But I don't work construction. So like, I am not going to be stuck lifting somebody else's mm-hmm. bricks, you know, so to speak. Like, I guess you could say somehow I'm having to pick up the slack of somebody else. But it's not strenuous for me. I slow down my interactions. I just take it real easy at work. And as soon as I clock out, I'm out. You know, like I work in retail and I don't have to think about my job after I leave. And that's the best part. And I feel like if I was in management, I wouldn't be able to do that. If I held grudges against my coworkers for calling out, I'd probably think about that after I leave. But I literally walk out the door and I just put on my headphones, podcast, walk to the subway, and I'm in not a happy spot. I'm more depressed that I'm leaving retail job and knowing that I have to come back to retail job, but I don't have to worry about some project or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's one of the upsides of retail, I guess, is that nobody's calling me I'm using air quotes right now, my weekend. Nobody's calling me on my weekend and asking me if I can do something for them or whatever. That's where all my podcast stuff, like my other job, I just got an email. I just got another gig while we're recording
this.
Which, yeah, it's great. You know, but it's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going to be like nipping at me on my time mm-hmm. off. And I just wish that I could be out of retail entirely and move into that territory.
Well, you're
of, you know, production stuff.
You're a bigger man than I, and I imagine that's probably why you've been able to do retail as long as you have. I was able to make it exactly 5 years, and I was miserable.
I mean, I'm 5 and a half right now.
Yeah. But I mean, you're able to separate at least a little bit when you leave. Like, I totally understand that. Like,
but you were management though. You were hiring people and stuff. You were making schedules and dealing with those call-outs. You were the one being affected. Like, I'm sure my managers are pulling their hair out when one of my colleagues calls out. You know, just because I don't feel it doesn't mean nobody feels it.
Yeah,
but that's you.
That's tough, like, too. But like, I was not always management, and at the end I wasn't management. I stepped down. Like, I stepped down to it. Like, it was still a key holder position, but I didn't have the responsibilities, or at least I shouldn't have. But that's debatable. But
yeah, that's
but well, it was an ongoing thing. But like, my job did not require me to do the things that were a lot more stressful because I had more responsibility and I had, you know, much bigger people looking at what I was doing. That definitely was stressful, but. Even when I was part-time, I was going on with those problems. It wasn't just like, oh, okay, like it's 10:15, I'm leaving the store, I have to open again at 8. Like, that definitely went through my mind.
Clopin. Yeah. Good old Clopin.
But even after, like, I like came to terms with that and set my alarms, I was drifting off to bed thinking about all the bullshit from the day. Like, and how, you know, that person who called off was a terrible person because they didn't consider, like, all of the extra work that everybody else is going to have to do. It wasn't even me that had to do with the work. Like, it's another associate at their level that's going to have to, like, pick up the slack on the registers or, you know, cleaning up footwear or whatever it is that they had to do. But, oh man, like,
well, there's clashes. Like, there's stuff, there's obviously things that I could reflect on at the end of the day. Like, if I had a really shitty customer that, and like a really bad interaction, I don't have them often. So when one does happen, yeah, like, I guess you could take that home with you. But that's the same as if, like, somebody, like, yelled at me on the subway or something, or, like, somebody bumped me on the subway or, like, told me to get the fuck out of the way or whatever, you know, if I was blocking a door, which, you know, they have the right to, but I would feel stupid. Like, oh, why were they rude to me? Like, that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about work. I'm not thinking about a project, the work itself. It's just usually about something bad that happened, and that can happen at any part of your day. So, like, yeah, I mean, if you were taking your job specifically home with you about those coworkers calling out, then that sucks, yeah. But, like I said, you were management at one point. You knew what you had a different set of empathetic skills for your leaders and coworkers and colleagues or whatever.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I think
it's bad. It's so bad, dude. You should have a limit. There should be a limit to how long you can do this. There are dudes that I work with that have been in the. And I'm sure this is, again, my limited perspective on this and my limited time in retail, but there are people that have been working for the company for 10 years in retail and are at my level, at my rank, I guess, maybe making a little bit more than me, but like, just, and I think they're awesome and they're some of the coolest people I have met, you know, they're like my new librarians, but at the same time, it's like, I definitely see the people that have been here for 5 years longer than I have. And I'm like, shit, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And like, I just remember, you know, that's kind of like the thing that I come home and think about. Like, that's the part that I do take home with me is the knowledge that I feel like I'm never getting out of it. And that's so messed up because you can just leave any time. Like I said, they would not feel it. I could quit tomorrow without 2 weeks notice and they would not feel it at all.
Yeah.
They would just be like, oh, okay, that dude sucks. Whatever. He's gone though. And hire somebody new. Promote somebody from within, hire somebody from outside. It doesn't matter. But I come home every day with the idea that I'm not going to be able to say, to put in my 2 weeks notice at some point because I don't have anything better to go to.
Yeah.
I also feel like that's
the reality hiding behind something that a lot of people feel. And maybe you don't. I know that I did. It's that mentality where it's like, yeah, I hate this place, but you know, like, what would this place be without me? And maybe that's not like a thing in your specific environment, which I feel is very unique, for a multitude of reasons, location and brand and, you know, all the things that play into that. But in a lot of smaller scale retail environments or even other jobs, you know, like food service, you know, like clerical things, like if I left, this whole place would fall apart. Like nobody knows how to do what I know how to do. Like this place is just going to be a wreck without me. Like I feel like that's a mentality that a lot of people have, and why when you see one person leave, you'll often see like a couple of other people leave because it's like a spiteful thing. It's like they've had such a terrible time in their job that when somebody finally gets the gumption to quit, they're like, you know what? Yeah, that guy was like one of the other people that knew what they were doing. And if they leave and I leave, they're screwed. Plus, they see that person leave. They're like, okay, like if I leave, it's totally okay. It's going to be okay for me. It's not going to be okay for them, but that's fine because I don't like them. And that's something I see all the time in retail. And sometimes it's with associates who are like actually really good at their jobs. And that is a loss. And in other cases, it's people who are, you know, even further deluded because they're not good at their jobs and they still feel that way. But
I lost 3 coworkers in August.
Yeah.
Just quitting, moving on to greener pastures.
And did it happen in bulk? Like what? Rapid succession?
I had a couple in one day.
Yeah.
And then like, I think a week later, the person who I like actually enjoyed seeing left. You know, like I guess you could call him my closest friend at work, even though I don't hang out with anybody for my job. But I barely, you know, text with them, but you could say like the person who I was closest to just left without saying anything, without being like, he put in his 2 weeks notice, but didn't tell anybody he did. And that's his business. So like, I'm not mad about that, But I am just like, oh, damn it, man. I'm sad about that. Yeah. I'm not mad. I'm sad about it. That I lost somebody like who I really enjoyed talking to and working alongside and who knew what they were doing. Yeah. And that, but that's, and it's another thing, like kind of shaking my fist being like, oh, when is it going to be my time? And my time could be any time, mm-hmm. you know, it could be like, it could be tomorrow, but I'm just not going to do it because I'm chicken shit, I guess. I think about this Marin interview. I forget who he was talking to. It was another comedian, and they were talking about how you can never, ever, you can't succeed at what you want to do unless you have no safety net.
Yeah. I've heard that a lot. I've probably heard that on Marin, but I've heard that a lot.
I don't know how I feel about it. I think there's some validity to it but I don't know what no safety net actually means.
Well,
I know.
Well, something has to push you. And if you're not going to like push yourself, you need to put yourself in a scenario where like you have no other choice. If you quit your job and you don't have something else,
mm-hmm.
you need to find something else. And if you need to find something else, you may as well find that thing that you want to do. That's like the best time to try it because you need something and you could just go like back
to where
you were.
That's like you get hungry for it. Like, so if I, so hypothetically speaking, I drop my 2 weeks notice tomorrow and I just have my safety net is whatever savings I have. And then what do I do from there? You know, like you say like, okay, well, I just want to go into audio production full time. And it's not just something you can snap your fingers and
right.
say like, okay, I'm going to go get hired at this audio production place. It's not, you have to, if you want to freelance, you've got to build up a repertoire, get a lot of clients, get word of mouth going around and also be really goddamn good at what you're doing.
Sure.
And like, I would say I'm probably intermediate with my work, you know, like I'm probably mid-level quality, you know, where I could be way better. I could know better. I could know more. I could know Pro Tools better than I do now.
Yeah,
and that would sell me
you're
so much harder. Yeah, but nobody wants to use Logic. Everybody wants to use Pro Tools. But anyway, so my lack of safety net is like, okay, I have rent due, you know, very soon, and I need to pay that rent, and my savings is dwindling. Mm-hmm. And so where do you go? You know, like you start begging for audio jobs. You go on Upwork, you go on Fiverr, mm-hmm. and start just like hustling and just putting people out there. Like
maybe, but
it's weird.
I feel like there's, especially with, I think this maybe applies less with skill jobs. I think when you hear somebody talking about something like that,
skill jobs.
Well, this is a skill job. Like being able to edit is a skill. Anybody who listens to the edits for this show and then listens to the edits of Bantha Fighter is going to know who the better editor is between the two of us. Like it's going to be clear.
There are no edits on this show.
That's exactly.
That's not fair.
I mean, I'm doing some stuff, but anyway, you're getting me off track. If you're listening to somebody telling you about the safety net on Marin, it's because they're talking about something creative. Usually it's like, okay, this person has a job and that job is keeping them from finishing a screenplay or going out for more auditions. And if they quit that job and it gives them more time and puts them in a position where like they have no choice but to try harder, that extra effort might be the thing that helps them in that interview or helps them in that audition or helps them like really sell the pitch because they have no other choice.
The extra hunger, you mean?
Yeah. Because they have to like, it's near a point of desperation for some people because like this has to work. And if it doesn't, like they're going to go to the next person. And for, again, it has to work. There is no fallback. That's what it means. No safety net. Like, okay, you could go pitch the same script while having, you know, like a fairly decent low salary job in an office somewhere. But if it doesn't sell, like that'll be disappointing, but it's not the worst thing in the world. You still have a paycheck. But when you don't, like you're going to put extra energy into it. And you know what? You might just sell it based on that. Like people are not just buying your pitch. Like they're buying a piece of you. And I feel like it's definitely easier in the creative process, but I think it applies to skill jobs as well, because like you're still going on interviews and like you can talk up everything that you're doing, but I think you can show a lot more of your passion if you need a job plus like you have an opportunity to apply for something that you really want to do. I think I'm not telling you to quit your job. That's not what I'm telling you to do on this episode, but it is something to think about because I mean, if it's, you know, if that's something you really want, like I know that you're applying and that you're like, you're putting in the work, but it's a
well, I think there's steps to take it before quitting the job. Like, I work full time in retail now, and I work another part time job on top of that with HeadGum. And you know, the hours aren't crazy, but you know, I have at least one show a week now, coming up on two, and the second show is a very heavily edited show. Mm-hmm. So that is going to be my second job. So I'll be working like 60 to 75 hours a week, probably, you know, once that kicks in. And you know, so what can you do to fix that? So I could switch to part-time retail, but the thing about part-time retail is no one want, like, there's no free ride, you know, like, mm-hmm. you have to give up something. And I guess you still get health insurance at part-time where I am. But you miss out on like stock benefits, sick time, vacation time. So essentially you're just, you call out sick and you're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. And also you lose the option to have weekends off ever. Like right now I have a retail schedule, which is just, you know, random days. Basically, in order to increase the likelihood of getting weekends off, I gave them open availability, which means they just plug me into gaps in the schedule. Mm-hmm. Whereas some people will say, I need to have Monday and Tuesday off. But that means they have to work Saturday and Sunday. So, but if you work part-time where I am, you have to, your availability has to be, is mandatory Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And you could get like a 4-hour shift on a Saturday morning or whatever, or a Saturday evening. You could, cause you can work late where like till 10 PM, you get a closing shift and end up working 6 to 10, 5 to 10 on a Saturday. And so that's a sacrifice that I would have to make. Mm-hmm. Like I would have to switch to part-time, give up my benefits, a lot of my benefits, the most lucrative benefits you could argue, and then give up my free time. Mm-hmm. And if like when I started in this job, I was working Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, cause I was part-time, and I moved to full-time within like within 6 months I was full-time. So what sacrifices am I willing to make? What sacrifice are you willing to make for the thing that you actually want to move towards? And with the idea that you might not actually get what you want in the end, you know, so what sacrifices was the person on Marin getting interviewed? What their safety net? So when we talk about safety net, you're talking about not having like a desk job to fall back on, not having some cushy job to fall back on. And it also means not, it means like taking a shitty restaurant job, taking a shitty bartending job or a shitty waiting job that keeps you out until 2 or 3 in the morning, but also something you can blow off in 2 seconds without thinking twice about it because you are fully replaceable. That's part of the safety net. It's a weird like piece of it where you have to sacrifice in different ways besides not being sure where your rent is going to come from, taking like doing stuff you don't want to do, like not having a weekend, not having sick time.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like going from full time to part time again was strange. Like I felt everything that you just said, because you're losing out on benefits, you're losing out on pay, like hours definitely in retail. And that stinks. But on the other hand, like it is freeing in a way. Like when I dropped down to full or to part time after being a manager for over 2 years. It was like, oh geez, like this is great. Like I definitely don't have as much money as I did. And that means like, I'm not going to be able to go out to eat as often with my girlfriend, and I'm not going to be able to buy Star Wars toys and books and comics and all these things anymore.
Some of these are positive things.
They are positive things. And I'm going to be looking to sell some stuff soon, which is cool. but like the amount of free time you get is super valuable. And I wouldn't even say that I'm like doing a whole lot with that. Like I was able to get like another part-time job that I really love. Like I absolutely love the job that I have with Breaker, and I hope to do that for a really long time. And that was the deciding factor on quitting my retail job. It's because I did have a safety net, and like I had another job that
was it a safety net though?
Well,
I think you have a goal. Like your safety net is gone. Like the idea is that you want to jump without the safety net is what the interviewer was saying.
Sure. I get that. But like,
you can't have a safety net.
I was able to find a job that is somewhat within the realm of what I want to do, but also, mm-hmm. also allowed me the freedom and
the supplemented pay to cut out the other job that I had, because there was no way that I could just go back to school and not work. Like I needed money at least right. to pay for gas, if not make payments on my loans, you know? So mm-hmm. when I was able to do that, and then I was able to get another part-time job, that was pretty great. Like it's still tight, but I was able to work my retail job and this other job that only gave me so many hours. And that eased it up a little bit. But as my responsibilities have been growing with Breaker, I've found an opportunity to just peace out, which is super great. But as an added benefit of that, like especially with this job, which is remote, and I can do essentially like whenever I want. Like oftentimes, I'm able to do my best work on the weekend because, you know, no classes, no meetings, no podcast recordings. Like it's a good time to get through. It's not the best time for people to get replies from a support email, but in some cases it is, because it's when those people are also free from their jobs and they're able to like help me troubleshoot an issue, or I'm able to like, you know, walk them through a process. But just that freedom, like even if I'm not doing anything with it, and you know, this show is a result of that extra freedom. But apart from that, like it's just nice to be able to dedicate more time to, you know, the thing that I'm working on. And in my case, that's school, like putting a shit ton of time into algebra. But with you, like if you were to drop down to part-time, like, yeah, you're going to miss out on a lot of benefits. And I don't know what your financial situation is or, you know, like the kinds of, like the bills and how you manage things with your partner. But if that were able to like give you the extra time that you needed to like build a portfolio or, go on more interviews, like I would totally support that. And again, not asking you to quit your job. Just saying that no, there is a benefit to it. Like even if you don't look at it from a safety net standpoint, like just the amount of time that you put into your job and then the amount of mental stress and just the weight of that you leave your job every day, even if you don't feel maybe as bad as I did or other people do when they leave their, you know, their really hard third shift jobs or something like that. They leave and it's like, okay, the sun's out, it's time to go to bed. Like people have really, really tough jobs and they feel like shit when they leave every single day and they stay in those jobs for decades. And I feel, you know, I feel bad for those people. I think they're incredibly hardworking, more hardworking than I'll ever be. But like, I can commiserate with them to a degree because I know what it's like to leave a job and have it suck. And I know the drain that can have on other aspects of your life. And that's not even limited to creative endeavors or aspirations. Like it's super far reaching. It goes into your personal relationships. It goes into your health. Like, bad jobs can be really bad for you. And I think that you and I have both been lucky to have more or less positive experiences in retail. You know, I've had to deal with like bad people, but like the job itself isn't that bad. It's at times even enjoyable. But you know, there's still a strain, and that strain affects a lot of portions of your life that, you know, should be taken into consideration when you start thinking about stuff like going down to part-time or looking for other work, because there are so many benefits to finding a job that's going to give you more freedom and more happiness during the job, because so much of your time is spent on the job. It's kind of like those like Casper mattress ads that you hear on podcasts, not on ours. I'm not gonna preach the benefits of a Casper mattress, but you know, it's
what about them?
Oh, sorry. You know, it's like you spend a third of your life on your mattress, like use
oh yeah,
so why not get the best mattress? And I think
that's a great marketing line.
It really is.
Honestly, yeah, it's more or less a fact. Yeah. You know, and
no, it's a good fact, and they're totally right. And it doesn't mean that you have to buy a Casper. Like you can buy a better.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, it also doesn't mean that Casper is quality. You know?
Yeah,
I've never actually slept on one. But you know, you could. I have friends that buy like the Amazon mattress for like a couple $100, and they're like, yeah, best night of sleep I had, best value, cheap enough for me to just leave whenever I have to move instead of actually taking it with me.
Yeah,
and they're like, yeah, they swear up and down by it.
Oh gosh, don't even get me started on mattresses, man. Like a new mattress will change your life, like completely turn your world around. But
we'll change that. We'll still save that for a topic for another day.
We'll save it for when Casper starts sending us that sweet, sweet mattress money. But
dude, that would be dope if they just fucking gave us a mattress. I could use a new mattress.
Like that's worth the thing. Like I don't even have to make money from the advertising. Just send me the mattress. Like those are worth a decent chunk of change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it applies to job hunts because, like, if you're going to spend a third of your life on your mattress, that gives you two-thirds of the rest of your life. And depending on how that math works out for you with a commute and how much time you're expected to spend in your job, another 30 of your life could be spent in a job. And sometimes it's, and oftentimes I think it's more than that. So if you're going to be spending a lot of time doing something, like, make it something that you really like. And that that it's doesn't fine, even mean that what you're doing is bad, because you may have at some point really liked it, but people change and their interests change. And if there's something else that you want to do more, go for it.
This is a lot like the conversation I have every Thanksgiving with relatives.
I'm sorry.
Back when I was pursuing music, like hardcore, and by hardcore, I mean, you know, just working, tutoring, and then going on tour with that other group. And they'd just say to you, like, oh, Michael, like, you should be on the radio. Like, you should just have your music played in the radio. Oh, you should get a manager. And here's what you really got to do. You got to open for bigger bands. Like, just do that. And I just sit there and be like, oh, that's a really great idea. Thank you so much, Aunt Tiffany. I don't have an Aunt Tiffany. But like, they're just saying these things to you. It's like, oh, well, like, yeah, if you want to go out, if you're going to spend two thirds of your life at your job or whatever, just go out there and make it something you want to do. It's like, well, the thing I want to do isn't necessarily pay that much. And the competition for doing what I want to do, which is chop up audio and make it really fucking good. I mean, you can do that from your bedroom, and you have to showcase that. And there are people that do it from their bedroom that don't get paid for it. And the places that do pay for it, probably, I mean, I fantasize about a job at Gimlet here in Brooklyn, but I don't know that that's the right choice for me. I like it to be the right choice for me, but who knows what happens when I start working there? Maybe it becomes super stressful and I take my job home with me every day and I'm working like 70 hours a week. I mean, you know, Ira Glass doesn't make it seem like it's fun at all with This American Life. Like, if you look at their fellowship positions that they have open twice a year, that it says, like, oh, be prepared to be working 60 hours a week at least, you know, especially during like heavy times, or like when we have something coming up.
Well, I don't think that there's necessarily a direct correlation to the amount of time spent and the enjoyability of the job, because there are people that do things that take a lot more hours than that and they enjoy it a lot. And I think anybody who works at, you know, This American Life or any one of those, like, you know, fine journalistic institutions, like, really genuinely enjoy the work that they're doing. And if it takes a ton of hours one week, that's great. Like, I think
it's funny that you said
don't even think about it,
because I worked on a podcast. I won't name the podcast I didn't like working on. I worked on a show. No, it's not Bantha Fodder. I enjoy working on that. But I was working on a show, like a very, I would call it like the well, I can't say the topic of it because that'll give it away, but it's a very This American Life type show. And, you know, human interest, narrative driven, narrator, interview kind of stuff. And that was excruciating to work with. And, you know, for a lot of different reasons. And now I'm working on, I'll say the name of the podcast that I do like working on. That's called Good One. It's a Vulture podcast, and in association with HeadGum. It's a podcast about jokes where, you know, Jesse, the host, interviews really amazing comedians about one joke they did. And that, editing that, I spend almost the same amount of time doing that, because they hand me like an hour and a half of tape and I have to essentially whittle it down to an hour or 45 minutes to an hour. So that means like really listening to segments and knowing where the cuts need to be made and knowing where to insert the ads and whatever. And so I'm spending probably the same amount of time I spend ratio wise that I do on Bantha Fodder, but I love listening to these comedians talk. It's just like listening to a comedy special just recorded for you and getting all like the B-side stuff of it. And so like that's,
oh yeah, you get to hear all the stuff that nobody gets to, like you got cutting room stuff, like,
well, and stuff that they don't want in. They're like, oh, I said something off color there for my brand of comedy. Yeah. It's not like that, so I should get rid of that. And
that's awesome.
This is not a blackmail situation by any means, but
no,
like,
of course,
just, you know, it's fun to just hear funny, smart people talking, because most of the New York City comedians are pretty good, the ones that are being interviewed in the show. And Jesse, the host, is hilarious too and really good at getting and like asking questions and stuff. But yeah, I forget where I'm going with this, but it was liking your job and taking it home with you, and how it can be, how like taking your job home with you could actually be really fun versus really stressful. And that's what I think about when I work at, like, you know, if I got the fellowship at This American Life or if I got the fellowship at Gimlet or whatever. you know, it's like, oh, is that going to be fun for me? Like, is that going to be super stressful?
Oh, I think it would be. I think there's no doubt that it would be stressful because it's like something that you're aiming for. And if you're able to,
right.
to get it, like, yeah, that's going to be like mega stressful. Like, imagine the interns that work at, you know, in the government, like, you know, they dream of being the president of the United States. And then somehow by miracle, like, to get an internship at the House of Representatives, I'd be shitting my pants, but it doesn't mean they can't do it. Like it's just, or that it's not going to be hard. It's going to be all those things, but,
or that you don't, well, I mean, or the idea that you don't like it. Like, again, let's loop back into something we talked about earlier. When you get to the point in your major right now, yeah. where you start integrating the trigonometry that you're trying to learn now,
yeah.
you know, like, and you figure out like, oh, I don't actually want to design the whatever, the Williams thing, like the app that needs angles and stuff to
sure,
paint a
sure
wall
lines.
Or whatever.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
yeah. Like that's the idea that, you know, I'm terrified that I'm going to figure out I don't like doing what I'm doing. Isn't that scary?
No. I mean, yes and no. No, I think you're right. Like, say that again.
I think I'm scared of finding out that I don't want to do what I think I want to do.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, you're, yeah.
That's
Sorry,
a lot of
I,
words.
I think I misheard you. Yes, I am terrified of that. Of course. Like, I left everything behind. Not that what I was doing was anywhere close to what I wanted to do, but I left a ton of stuff on the table to go back to school to do this thing. And yeah, I'm terrified all the time, especially when I'm like getting stuck on, even in like basic classes like math. Like, this is not a core class. This is not learning C++ or Java or, you know, any other actually useful programming language. It's just mathematics. Like, I all the time feel like, oh my gosh, like, this is tough and it's only going to get harder, you know? And when I think about that, I'm like, well, I'm pushing for this thing and I got to get to this thing. But then if I get to this thing and I'm not good at it or whatever, like, what do I do? Because I've just put myself back in debt. I left a full-time job. Like, I'm going to have to find something else. And what is that going to mean for me? Is that going to mean going back to school to finish another degree? Is that going to mean just giving all up and just taking something that I can just do? Yeah. Yeah. I totally get that. I feel that.
I watched Adaptation last night with Aaron.
That's a good movie.
It is a good movie for this topic.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. But, you know, just the whole fuck fish scene is really great. You know, it's like, you know, one day I woke up and decided, fuck fish. Yeah. You know, like, that's such a good, like, to just move from thing to thing like that, dude. But I think what was the moral of it? It was, you know, like, life is not what loves you, it's what you love, you know? So that was an interesting way to come, interesting intersection between what we watched last night and this.